Okay, we'll bring the Mining and Outdoor Recreation Committee to order. We do have a quorum. Representative Metza, you had an opportunity to look at the minutes.
They were great, Mr. Chair.
Representative Metza moves the minutes. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Well, today is going to be Trail Day in the Mining and Outdoor Recreation Committee. And with us first up is Representative Bennett. And she'll have a couple of testifiers. And what we're going to do with the motion for her bill will be to send it to the General Register. Some of these other bills we're going to be sending to the Environment and Natural Resources Policy and Finance Committee, some bonding bills, and the Barrett bill we'll be sending to Civil Law. So with that, today we have Representative Bennett, and the chair will move House File 449 for consideration, and we will be moving that to the General Register if approved. Welcome to the committee, Representative Bennett, and please proceed with telling us about your bill.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Good to be here. This is actually my first presentation in a committee that I don't belong to, so it's kind of fun to see different faces. This is actually a fairly simple bill. What we're looking at is designating the Shell Rock River as a water trail in the statute. You maybe have heard the Albert Lee before, and land between the lakes is our kind of a motto when you're traveling between Iowa and the Twin Cities. People pass through our beautiful lakes. We have a beautiful area. So water is key to our city. The state in the past has invested money into Albert Lee Lakes, first cleaning up the Edgewater Dump, which was right next to Fountain Lake. Then the Lathard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council and other projects were restoring and protecting habitat and so on for a number of different years. So it's something that the state has invested in. Our community also has invested in our lakes quite a bit. We have a local option sales tax that has matched most of the state's investments. And so we have a lot of support in our city for this. So for the Shell Rock River Water Trail, I'm actually not going to say a lot. I have a couple of people here to testify from Albert Lee, and so I'll let them come up and
please
introduce themselves.
Please come forward.
So thank you.
Who wants to go first? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Yes, my name is Bill Howe, and thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My position is that I'm the chair of the Shell Rock River Watershed District Advisory Committee, and approximately a year ago we decided that we would take on a project that would benefit the watershed district and create an educational environment where we could show that we have some very nice resources in our county and within the watershed district. So we created the Shell Rock River Water Trail. It's a trail that's composed of about 25 miles. It starts in Edgewater Park. It traverses through Fountain Lake, eventually into Albert Lee Lake, and then it enters the Shell Rock River, which is about 13 miles of river. And again, the entire trail is 25 miles. It has a lot of the amenities already in place. There's a state park, Elmer Big Island State Park, which borders the northern edge of Albert Lee Lake. There are remote campsites there for the canoers and the kayakers, and it's a very pristine area. It encompasses a metro area, goes through some farmlands, and also this pristine area where there are bald eagles, cranes, beaver, a very beautiful scenic area. And we're asking that this become one of the next water trails designated by the DNR within the state of Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent.
Thank you. My name is Susie Peterson. I am the Executive Director of the Albert Lee Convention and Visitors Bureau. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'd just like to piggyback on what Peggy said about our land between the lakes. Albert Lee Lake is the very first lake that you see as you come in on 35 into Minnesota. It's a beautiful, vast lake. We are very blessed to have these lakes in our community. Fountain Lake is built around our Albert Lee. The water trail that we would like designated when it starts at Fountain Lake Albert, on the west edge of Albert Lee, and it goes all the way through. What's unique about it goes through lakes and the river. And we have been very fortunate to have a community boathouse that has, they've put on programs for education on the water. They've had over 2,000 kayaks and canoes just in the last year, and we are just so fortunate to have this. This would create, we feel, so much more tourism and economic impact in our area. Southern Minnesota has a lot of wonderful lakes, and we want to be the northern Minnesota, but southern Minnesota, come to our part of the country, too, for the lakes, because it's a beautiful area. So we're asking you to please give us the state designation for the water trail. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, any questions of Representative Bennett or her testifiers? Hearing none, the chair will renew his motion that House File 449 be referred to the General Register. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed, motion prevails. The bill is passed and sent to the General Register. Thank you for your testimony. Thank you for
Thank
coming
you so
in.
Much.
Thank you.
Thank you. You're welcome. Representative Barrett. Welcome to the committee, Representative Barrett. The chair will move House File 793 with the recommendation that it be re-referred to the Environment and Natural Resources Policy and, the Civil Law Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm just going to give you a brief update of the bill, and then I have two people with me today. I have Amy Frischman from Wild Mountain Ski Area and Brandy Ream from Spirit Mountain. Amy will go over the skiing and snowboard industry in Minnesota, and Brandy will go over the bill in
one of my favorite spots to ski.
Wild Mountain. Very good. Again, thank you, Representative Bob Barrett here. I'm happy to bring House File 793, the Minnesota Skier Safety Act, to you today on behalf of the Minnesota Ski Areas Association. Alpine skiing and snowboarding are vibrant outdoor recreation activities in Minnesota and a key component of our winter tourism economy and a critical piece to Minnesota's overall tourism. Ski safety laws govern the responsibility of skiers in 28 states, governing more than 90% of the skiers in the country. Minnesota has the 12th largest ski is the 12th largest ski state in the country and the only major ski state that has not adopted Skier Safety Act provisions. A component of the Skier Safety Act is that skiers abide by the 50-year-old national set of guidelines on skier safety called the Skier Responsibility Code and assume certain risks of the sport of skiing, and that ski areas assume the certain educational signage and ski lift responsibilities as well. The Ski Safety Act promotes safety by balancing the responsibilities of both skiers and ski areas that will be consistent at every ski area in the state. Skiers are encouraged to ski safely by being informed of the risks inherent in skiing, being provided with maps and signage to navigate around the ski areas, and being required to ski under control and with the care of their own safety and the safety of others in mind. Ski areas promote safety by being required to operate their lifts in accordance with the 180-page national treaties governing ski lifts, taking measures to eliminate or control risks to a skier who is skiing under control, and providing clear signage and information on the risks of skiing. The bill is a balanced approach with skiers and ski areas assuming certain clear responsibilities. With that, Amy Frischman is here from Wild Mountain to talk about skiing in Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee. Just state your name and who you represent for the record.
My name is Amy Frischman, and I'm with Wild Mountain. And thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. On behalf of the Ski Area Association, we appreciate you taking the time to listen to us today. This legislation is a top priority for our association. I am representing all the ski areas in Minnesota. And in addition to myself, we have Brandy here from Spirit Mountain, as well as Welch, Afton, and Highland Hills here with us as well today. Minnesota's ski industry is a mixture of family-owned, non-profit, and municipally operated ski areas. My ski area, Wild Mountain, in Kalis Falls, is family-owned. My brother and I are the second generation to own and operate the ski hill. At Wild Mountain, we have 26 runs, 4 chairs, 3 ropes, a conveyor, and a snow tubing hill. Last year, our association did an economic study of alpine skiing and snowboarding in Minnesota. You have the executive summary in your handout, but I'd like to take a few minutes to showcase this report. As you know, winter sports in Minnesota play an important role in our overall tourism economy. Winter activities are often the key link to the overall tourism economy in rural Minnesota, providing jobs when needed most and providing a vital counterbalance to the typical summer-fall orientation of rural economies. Skiing is an active, healthy, family-oriented, outdoor recreational activity in the wintertime when recreational activities are sometimes limited in Minnesota. The total direct and secondary output effects of the alpine ski and snowboard resort industry in Minnesota was $401.2 million in 2012-2013 season. This spending benefits ski areas directly, our communities, and retailers related to the industry throughout the state of Minnesota. As a business that is weather dependent, anything we can do to stabilize our costs, help us remain viable, we expect that this legislation will do that. The Ski Safety Act is important to our industry because it improves the safety aspects of ski areas and encourages responsible behavior by skiers. As operators under this legislation, we understand that we will have specific responsibilities in the area of safety that we will need to follow and take care of. We as an industry are willing and ready to take this on. Thank you again for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Mr. Chair, next we have Brandy Ream from Spirit Mountain.
Excellent. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Brandy Ream, excuse me, Spirit Mountain. I have suddenly gotten a frog in my throat, so please excuse me. I am going to, Mr. Chair, members, provide you an overview of the bill today. Section 1 simply states the Minnesota Skier Safety Act. Section 2 gives you definitions, provides clear definitions of all terms that will define the risk, responsibilities, and liabilities assumed by skiers and the ski areas also. Section 3, skier duties and assumed risk, places in statute the skier responsibility code, which, as previously stated, is a 50-year-old code used by ski industries across the United States to provide guidelines for safe skiing and specifies skiers the conditions and the risk of skiing. A skier is also responsible to know their own abilities and not ski on trails out of those abilities, not to ride lifts in a manner that risk injury, and to use care that an ordinary prudent skier would. Section 4, ski area and operator responsibilities. This details the responsibilities and liabilities of ski areas, including maintaining and inspecting lifts in compliance with the ANSI ski lift code, also documents and specifies safety requirements for the installation, maintenance, and operation of the ski lifts. Thank you very much. Requirements to post large signs close to where ski lift tickets are purchased by skiers and notify skiers of the risk of skiing and responsibilities assumed by skiers. A comprehensive system of marking the difficulty of each ski slope with signs near the beginning of each ski slope, and requirements to make trail maps showing the ski area's trail system available to skiers in several locations, and also provide maps that one can carry with them. The requirement to barricade the entrance to freestyle terrain parks and install warning and instruction signs at the opening of each barricade. A requirement that ski lifts that do not serve easier terrain have warning signs so that skiers know that the lifts will serve what sort of terrain, as well as requirements concerning the marking, flagging, and inclusion of flashing lights on ski area vehicles when present on the ski slopes. Section 5, comparative fault, clarifies that fault under the comparative fault statute includes the risk assumed by skiers under the Ski Act, failure by a skier to adhere to the responsibilities under the Act, and failure by a ski area to adhere to these responsibilities under the Act. Section 6 is notice of claims, provides the same level of protections enjoyed by municipally owned ski areas under the Minnesota statutes by extending the requirement of a 180-day per occurrence notice of intent to sue the private ski areas. And Section 7, the effective date to be August 1, 2015. We thank you for your time, Mr. Chair and members, and we'll answer questions.
Okay. Members, questions. Representative Russo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I've talked with some of the people concerned with the bill in advance about a couple of these things. First of all, on line 2.12 and 2.13, a skier is defined as a person of any age or physical or mental ability. So how does this bill deal with minors? This is, you know, this definition of the skier is then applied among the people that have the responsibility on the hill. So how does this apply to minors and to people of diminished capabilities?
Who would like to take that? Representative Bennett?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Russo. I might want to phone a friend of counsel here, because I know that minors have a particular part of state statute that deals with what is obligated to minors. I think the intent of the bill here, this section of the bill, and I think Amy might have some thoughts on it as well, is to talk about safety and the fact that we want everyone skiing to be safe. So everyone would be affected by both the requirements of, certainly the requirements of the ski operators and making sure that the ski areas that they manage are safe for everyone. Amy, if you want to add to that.
You know, when we talked a little bit about this and you talk about the responsibility code, for those of you that are skiers are familiar with the responsibility code, you see it listed on websites, at the ski area, on trail maps. When we go before school groups, we oftentimes talk about the responsibility code. Regardless of someone's age, the responsibility of a skier is to know the responsibility code, to act safely on the hill, to know how to properly load a chairlift, know how to look above you when you're crossing lanes on a ski area or on a ski hill. And it doesn't magically happen when someone turns 18. A youth would also need to know and understand that, and we teach that in our lessons as well.
Thank you, Ms. Frischman. And Representative Russo, some of these issues that we're touching on will probably be answered in civil law.
Yes, and that was, you know, when I had a conversation earlier today, that was how we left that, that I'm bringing them up to make sure that there's an opportunity between now and when it hits civil law to address this, because although the education is aimed at, you know, educating people about that, we're putting into statute that the skier has the responsibility for this, 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 and the other thing. And the definition is claiming that it would apply to everyone, and I think that that would run contrary to how we might treat minors in other places. And so, you know, this is about liability, and it is about things that could land in court, and so I really, really hope that that gets a hard look from some lawyers before you hit civil law, because there'll be a lot of lawyers at the table in civil law. And then, let's see, on line 2.16 and 2.17, it makes clear that skiing, as defined in this, applies to skis, snowboards, sleds, etc., which is relevant when we come to line 3.18. This is among the skiers' responsibilities. There's a separate section for operator responsibilities, and I'm going to be contrasting this with what's in the operator responsibilities. On line 3.18, it states that the skier is responsible for the location, construction, design, layout, configuration, and condition of ski trails. Now, condition is something that's variable, and that's, in my opinion, quite reasonable to expect the skier to keep that in mind, because that's the snow conditions and ice and bare ground and whatnot. However, some of these things are not under the control of the skier. The location, construction, design, and layout are not under the control of the skier or snowboarder, and they're not really readily evident to the skier or snowboarder. Particularly the design and the construction of some of the features that might be in the snowboarding part of the hill, where you've got ramps and pipes and things like that. And so I would think that this part, almost everything that's on this particular line, line 3.18, is in reality the responsibility of the park to do properly, and not something that a skier can be reasonably expected while they're coming down the hill, which is their first view of these things. Because you don't get to walk up the hill and inspect things on your own. So your first view is when you're skiing down the hill, and I'm now supposed to assess and take responsibility for the design and the layout and so on of some of these features. So I don't think that that's reasonable. And I said I'd contrast it. You cannot find anything in the operator responsibilities that has anything whatsoever to do with the design and maintenance of the physical features of the hill other than the lift. So that part, I think, is inappropriate. And then on 4.19, it talks about the trail maps and the designations of the difficulty levels. And here I'm going to plead a little bit of ignorance. I don't know what the industry weighs in on this. But it says using the standards in subdivision 5 as far as the skill levels. So when I look at subdivision 5, it lists the labels, but I'm not seeing the standards. So do those standards exist elsewhere? And if so, how come that's not referenced here? So what is the standard for Black Diamond? Okay, where's the breaking point? Because I don't know, you know, if you go from one hill to another hill, and this is, again, I said plead ignorance. Does the industry maybe already has this worked out? But if they do, then we should somehow see some reference to that, you know, just to make sure. Because you want, you know, as an industry, you want to make sure that you're holding each other to the same thing. I mean, I do wall climbing, and there's a 5.20 difficulty, you know, that, I mean, that is actually a standard. So does that standard exist? Is the first question.
Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Caruso. I will ask one of my testifiers if there is a standard related to both the size of the hill. I think what you're getting at, Representative Caruso, is whether there is a standard for a double black diamond as it relates to both the incline and the length and any other physical parts of the slope that would indicate then it goes from a single black diamond to a double black diamond. Are there any state or national standards that relate to that?
Mr. Chair, just one.
Representative Urizen.
Absolutely. Yeah, my concern there is because we're putting the responsibility on the skier to assess that for themselves, and again, their only knowledge of it is that sign that's put up there.
Right.
So that's all. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mezza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First off, thank you for bringing this bill forward. I know our area resorts supported our ski hills. And I just kind of wanted to go through, I guess I have a different opinion. I've been skiing since I was a little kid. And when you go up and you're looking, you're standing over that black diamond, usually it's your parents' responsibility to say, no, you shouldn't probably go down that, you're not ready. And for me, I know I was usually the kid that went right over as soon as my dad said no. And so I think, you know, part of it, we can have signs up all over the place and put all these obligations up, but skiing's dangerous. You fall, you get hurt if you're not responsible. And the big thing is being responsible. And I think the whole idea is what I'm seeing here in Subdivision 3 anyway is all you want is people to say, I know that I need to check into this and make sure that I'm being a responsible skier by taking the liability, I guess, off of some of the places for not having a sign, for example, for a double black diamond. Like, I think part of it in enjoying the great outdoors, I mean, we could go put a sign on a four-wheeler trail saying, big log up ahead, you know, but hopefully aren't ripping through the woods at 50 miles an hour on a designated state trail, of course. And running those things. So long story short, I guess I would disagree, Representative Urizen. I think some of this is on the people going out and doing the skiing and that we need to kind of let them manage their own families and responsibilities.
Representative Barrett.
No, just to that point, Mr. Chair and Representative Mensah, I think you and I had similar but exactly opposite experiences on the slopes in that my first time was at Wild Mountain with my fifth grader. The fifth graders always go to Wild Mountain. And I, as her dad, wanted to chaperone but also get a feel for skiing. And so while she was willing and able to run down that hill, I'm the one that didn't want to go because the green circles still kind of scare me, and those blue squares, I don't know, I went down them a couple times and kind of regret that experience, so just wanted to share my experience with you as well.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Barrett, just wanted to thank you for bringing the bill up. Mount Cato owner or manager approached me in the Thunder Bar the other night and talked about this and said he'd really appreciate it if we passed it, so I already got a hold of Peggy Scott in the Civil Law Committee and asked her to give it a favorable result when it gets there. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative McNamara.
Well, Mr. Chair, it's interesting. Representative Cornish met his ski operator at the bar, and I met Mr. Nelson recently at church, so that's... I couldn't resist Representative Cornish. You probably spend more time in church than I do, for all I know, Representative Cornish. But, Mr. Chair and Representative Barrett, thank you for bringing this bill forward. As someone who has spent time in the emergency room with a son who I believe knew better than to go down the hill he went down, but what happens, happens. And I certainly don't think we should be running to the ski operator to sue their tail because my kid was having a great time. I think it's reasonable. This is a good bill. I appreciate that. And skiing's a lot of fun, something we do as a family. And part of this bill has come forward because of some unfortunate situations where I think people took advantage of the situation. And this is a good common sense bill, and I look forward to supporting it, and that's why I'm a co-author. Thank you.
Representative Lee.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and you know I'm very tempted to get into all the legal aspects of this bill and you know the limitations it puts on people to be able to seek remedies in the court system, but I'm not going to do that because it's not the right committee. But because this is mining and outdoor recreation, I guess I'm just trying to figure out how this will improve our ski areas in Minnesota, increase tourism. What is this going to do for outdoor recreation in Minnesota, Representative Barrett?
Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moline. Well, as I see it, it will provide standards for safety that both the skier and the ski owner are responsible for. That will lead to fewer accidents and a more safe environment for skiing in Minnesota. Both sides have responsibilities, and this bill codifies those responsibilities as it relates to having a good time on a ski slope. It's similar language, not the same, similar to what many, many other states have in the country. There's 28 states that have a Ski Safety Act provisions. And we are the only major ski state that doesn't currently have one. There are other smaller states, but they have relatively few people skiing in those states. And so what this does is codifies the aspects of skiing that are responsible for both the skier and their responsibility and also the ski owner.
Representative.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I know this bill is going to civil law, but I guess I have a hard time seeing how this will sort of improve our ski hills or increase access to people or improve tourism or maybe some of those other lofty goals that we often have in this committee when it comes to outdoor recreation, which obviously we value greatly in this state. I guess I more see it as, you know, taking away a lot of the responsibility that the ski owners have as far as negligence goes and basically just shifts the cost to somebody who could be seriously injured on the hill and, you know, have a much more burdensome legal process that they have to go to in order to cover their medical bills, et cetera. But I'm not going to get into those issues, but, you know, I just, maybe we can talk further about how this will, you know, you and I offline, about how this could actually improve our ski areas, because we do have Giants Ridge up in our area, which is actually, you know, under ownership of the IRRB in the state of Minnesota, and you know, I know that they've had liability issues there before, and I know that they've been sued before by people who've been injured. So, you know, I do follow these issues somewhat closely, but I would like to see how it would improve our ski areas, aside from the fact that injured people will be paying more out of their pocket and the owners will be paying less out of theirs. So, thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Representative Barry, I want to thank you for bringing this forward. There's some great ideas in this bill. But what I see with this bill is just puts the responsibility where it belongs. The skiers have responsibilities. The owners of the facilities have responsibilities. What was even better, it makes a standard in talking with some of the people. With the trails, it's the standard that's not just in Minnesota, because right now we have resorts that have different signs for different trails. They could be the same type of trail, have two different signage. This makes the standards of the state the same, not only across the state, but the other 28 states that have this. So if you go to any of these states, you see the double diamond, you know, that's the, for me, that'd be the one I'd never want to go down. I want it not quite that much fun anymore. I'm not as young as I used to be. When I was in high school, I'd jump at that double diamond. And I'd usually pick myself up before I got down to the bottom of the hill. But it also makes, in statute, makes the owners of the facilities responsible for making sure there's proper signage. And everything is done to the what needs to be done to keep people safe. If they don't follow that and have that stuff done properly, they are liable. And they're going to do everything they can to make sure that they follow the statutes and get as much signage and make the hills and the slopes as safe as possible. And that's what they want. Because the last thing they want is somebody to get hurt. Because when somebody gets hurt, it shuts that slope down and the other people using them are left out, and they do not want to leave the other skiers left out.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been skiing most of my life. 1969 I started. I see that the hill that I grew up skiing on is not depicted on here because it's closed, has been closed for a long time. Place that maybe people in the industry might recall, it's called Val Chatel, north of Park Rapids. That's where I started. Mr. Barrett, I want to thank you for bringing this bill up, but not just for what's in it, but for something that's not in it. I've been waiting for a long time, actually not waiting, but I've been anticipating for a long time that somebody's going to throw a bill out that's going to require helmets when you ski. I'm old school. You won't see me ever on the hill with a helmet. It's my risk, and I assume the responsibility. So I notice that that's not in there. I see that even in the freestyle section, it's recommended, which I don't have a problem with that. I'll be skiing Steamboat Springs this coming Saturday without my helmet, so thanks for leaving that out of this bill, too.
Further discussion? Anyone from the audience like to speak for or against the bill at this point? The bill will be going to civil law next. Seeing no further discussion, the chair will renew his motion that House File 793 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. The bill has passed to civil law.
Thank you.
Thank you for your presentation. Thank you for coming in today. Next bill on the agenda is Representative Dill. Members of the, I think all of these, are these all three bonding bills?
Yes.
They will all be referred to Representative McNamara's Committee on Environment, Natural Resources, Policy, and Finance, where he will probably have a capital investment bill that he will move on to the Capital Investment Committee. Representative Dill, welcome to your committee.
Well, House File 810, I'd like to put it before the committee, sir.
Please proceed.
Right. Mr. Cervenek is with me. He's the holder of almost all knowledge relative to the expansive development and history, long history of the Mesaba Trail, the counties which it passed, the legislators and constituents, who it affects, and what the benefits are. And I will let him explain the bill. It's a straight-up appropriation bonding funds, of which the origin is the general fund, of which it is paid back over 20 years on projects that are considered bondable by council. Mr. Cervenic.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Gary Cervenic, and I represent the Mesaba Trail, which is operated by the St. Louis and Lake County Regional Railroad Authority.
Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, House File 810 is fairly straight up. It's a $1.7 million request for a section of the Mesaba Trail between the Vermilion State Park and Sedan towards Ely. To give you a little bit of an overview, Mr. Chairman and members, the Mesaba Trail runs from the Mississippi to the Boundary Waters, from Grand Rapids to Ely. It's not a state trail. It's a regional trail of statewide significance operated by the Regional Railroad Authority. So far, 115 miles have been completed of the trail, and by the end of the summer, 121 miles will be completed, an average cost of $125,000 per mile. And Mr. Chairman and members, we're particularly proud of that because I think it's a reasonable investment for a good goal for the state of Minnesota. And we've done this without once exercising eminent domain or acquiring any property from an unwilling participant. Almost all of the length of the trail has been done on easements obtained by willing partners. We've spent less than $100,000 acquiring right-of-way since 1995 on this project, and of that, we've resold most of it except for about a value of $40,000. So I think it's been a good investment. We have a very low administrative staff. We have a total of 2.5 full-time equivalents building, operating, managing, and running this trail since 1995. The request continues our push from the Vermilion State Park towards Ely. It is a very unique section of the trail. It goes over hills and around rock outcroppings and lakes. And one of the unique features of the Mesaba Trail, it's not just a rails-to-trails conversion. It is actually goes through abandoned mining right-of-way and logging roads and on railroads as well as virgin areas in this region. Passes through 28 communities and connects them together. Presenting the Mesaba Iron Range in a very unique fashion to people who are passionate about the outdoors. And we're very proud to say, Mr. Chairman, that 31 miles of this is co-located with snowmobile trails, and we have a multiple use philosophy when we're moving forward on the trail when possible and working with other groups throughout the region. And so with that, I think that gives you a decent overview, and I'll stand for any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Questions, members? Oh, Representative Urizo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say thank you for bringing this forward. My son once biked from Shoreview to Fort Francis by way of Embarrass and would have much appreciated having some of this trail available at the time because he had to do it on the side of highways. So this would be terrific to provide these safer routes for people.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, Representative Dill, do you happen to know, I noticed this has a wheel pass. How many folks purchase that pass on an annual basis or to the test player?
Representative Dill?
Not me, but Mr. Cervenic, I thought I'd be able to answer that question.
Mr. Cervenic?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, not very many. We don't have an enforcement mechanism. The Railroad Authority has made a point of not policing and ticketing people because the trail is not completed. We've had segments in the 121 miles length that don't connect some communities. And so we've taken more of a hands-off approach that we're trying to initiate the wheel pass program. It goes into a fund for the long-term maintenance of the trail when we have to start repaving it. It's a relatively reasonable level. But I will get you the exact statistics over the last several years, and I don't have them with me.
Further questions? Anyone in the audience that would like to speak for or against the bill? Seeing none, Representative Dill renews his motion that House File 810 be re-referred to the Committee on Environment, Natural Resources, Policy, and Finance. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Next on the agenda, Representative Lewick. Thank you. Representative Lewick will move House File 790 for re-referral to the Committee on Environment, Natural Resources, Policy, and Finance. Welcome to your committee, Representative Lewick. Please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. On behalf of the entire folks surrounding the Cuyuna Lakes area, I'd like to speak just a little bit about it's really a great opportunity for our area. Back in 1993, we designated an area, it's called the Cuyuna Country State Recreation Area. It belongs to the Department of Natural Resources, people of Minnesota. In a previous life, it was the Cuyuna Iron Range. The mine pits, the dumps, that whole facility. We haven't mined there since the early 60s. In fact, one of those beautiful trout lakes there, the Pennington, my dad worked in there in the late 60s, the very last mine that operated there. So we're doing a lot of things here. That facility right now, we've got kayaking, canoeing, mountain biking, as you're going to hear a lot more about. Winter cycling, we've got paved cycling trails, we've got scuba diving, we've got trout fishing, a whole lot of things. And this is really a huge effort. It's got a lot of community support. You'll see in your packages there are resolutions from Crosby, City of Crosby, Ironton, Riverton, Cuyuna and Brainerd Lakes Chamber of Commerce, Brainerd Lakes Economic Development Corporation. This is a huge community effort. It's a very important element for economic development. And if you just think about this, we did that last mining there, 61, 62. I was at the kitchen table when Dad come home and said, "It's over, we either move or I go find a different line of work," and he decided not to move. It took until 1993 before we really grabbed that real estate and tried to make it into something that would start to reclaim the economic benefits that those mines had. So this is, everybody's got a story. I've actually got a piece in this from a personal standpoint. What we're asking for is a lot of money, make no mistake, $4.2 million. But the community has put together a long-range 21st century vision for where we want to go with this. So I don't mess that up. What I'd like to do, Mr. Chair, is turn it over to Aaron here, and he can give you an oversight. You've got a really, really simple thing that lays it out here on a piece of paper, but I would like to introduce Aaron Hotelhagen. Provide you some real detail on what we're trying to do here.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Aaron Hautala. I represent the International Mountain Bicycling Association and the Cuyuna Lakes Mountain Bike Crew, which we are a chapter of IMBA. As my name might suggest, Hautala, there's a little bit of Finnish going on there. A lot of people smiling. Roots go back to the Mesabi Range. Pretty proud of that. It's pretty cool to be that. But today we're not talking about the Mesabi, we're going to talk about Cuyuna. And we're going to talk about the master vision for trails for this region within the Cuyuna Country State Rec Area. About the crew, I'm the elected president of the crew. We are the designated trail stewards for the state of Minnesota. I'd like everyone to know that we're 100% volunteer. There's nothing we're paid for. Everything we do is for the trails, and we put it back into the trails. Last year, we donated over 1,400 hours of volunteer work on the trails. And we now do it year-round because of what's in front of you right there, which is a bike that allows us to pedal through the winter. We as a club invested $10,000 just into this master vision because we believe it was something important for our region. And when I say region, I mean probably a 60-mile radius of Crosby-Ironton. And I'd like to thank the crew members who are with us today. They're back there. They're passionate as well. In your packets, Representative Lewick mentioned the Master Vision for Trails brochure. And most importantly, I think, those resolutions. I've asked folks that have a longer shelf life than me in this region, when was the last time you had this many towns all come together and say, "We believe in this"? And not many of them have said they've seen it before. So I think that's something we're really proud of as a team. And we're also proud that our partners are here with us today. regional partners, chamber people in the back, just stand up for, so we can see who you are. We have Jessica with the Cuyuna Chamber. We have Amanda with the Aiken Chamber. If there's another chamber person back there, I can't see them, so I apologize. So the master vision, it's all about driving economy, jobs, and the opportunity in our region. Yes, it calls for trails, but these trails are economic trails. And that's the heart and soul of Cuyuna. It always has been. How can we take this land and do great things with it and render economy for it? So I want to get to the point as well, because you guys have had a long day. You've had a lot of discussions, and I want to go to the heart of the matter. Currently, we have one day of riding without repeating a trail. That's a day trip for most of our customers. They come up, and they're able to they ride 25 miles of single track, which sounds like that would be days and days of riding. But they do it in 4 to 6 hours, which means a lot of them can drive up from Minneapolis-St. Paul or drive back, or come from Wisconsin or Iowa, other states, and drive back. And we want to expand that opportunity. The master vision purposely calls for 3 days of riding without repeating a trail. And why that's important to have 3 days of riding is that means two nights in the beds in our region. And again, not everyone's going to stay in Crosby-Ironton. They're going to stay in Brainerd. They're going to stay in Pequot. They're going to stay in Aiken, Garrison, Isle. They come from a big area. And that 30 miles also, or the 3 days, will call for 50 additional miles to be built to pull that off. And again, this is a reason of economics. We didn't just want to come up with a great number, you know, of miles. It's, no, what will it take to retain people in our communities for the length of time to increase our economy? And that mileage, those 50 miles, we're also looking at not just building, you know, for expert trails. We want to build true beginner trail. So someone who's never been on a mountain bike can get on a trail, and it's as wide as this desk we're sitting on. It's gravel, and if they fall down on the grass there. There's not an 80-foot downslope where there's not big rocks. Because we want this to be a feeder system for people to get active and be outdoors. We also want to do expert trail. You heard about it in the ski story. But there's people that want the expert opportunity. We have that because of the mine tailings. And then we also want to provide trail for handicapped cyclists. Not everybody can go on a bike like this. They can sit and use their hands, and we believe they deserve a fair shot too. And what's nice about all of this is it complements what's already there. Representative Lewick talked about it. The kayaking, the paddle boarding, the road biking. So that's what we're looking for, the overnight stays. And what that overnight stays is going to bring to us is that increased economy, but also increased property value. We're already seeing property values alongside the rec area and in town being of desire, where people are now looking at buying a $40,000 house to have as their base camp. They come from Minneapolis-St. Paul and have a base camp and stay there. And we also want to use these trails as a 21st century tool to recruit talent and to retain that talent to our area for the businesses that already exist. So the good news is all the land we need to do it is already there. It's within the borders of the Cuyuna Country State Rec Area. That's a really good thing. We've been working with the state, the DNR, since 2011 on this plan. So it's not, you know, spur of the moment and a whim. And our region believes in it, and that's what I'm proud about. If it was just me coming here and saying, here's a great idea, that's one thing. But we have a region behind us, and we're proud of that. So the economic impact we currently have with 25 miles of single track is $2 million annually. We've worked with our economist, and when the master vision is completed, 3 days of riding without repeating a trail, he is forecasting a conservative estimate of $21 million into our community annually and sustainable. So it's a major jump, a major opportunity. Again, that isn't just Crosby-Ironton. That's going to cover a wider spread. And that's what we're excited about. That's what the trails are for. That's how we want to use them. The $4.2 million we're asking, that will go to engineering, to design, to construction of the new trails. There's two parcels within the rec area that need to be acquired for what the DNR would like to do it for campgrounds and an expert trail. But it's already within the boundaries, and that's an important legislative note. And then we, the crew, we're there. When this gets built, we're already signed up to keep maintaining it and keep growing our club so that we can keep being the trail stewards and keep this property as a prime example of what Minnesota can do when we work together. So in closing, the bike before you today isn't just a bike. We had to bring a bike, but there's a reason for it. It's our state's tool to reduce health care costs. It's our state tool to unite communities, And better yet, this is a Minnesota-made bike. The frame, the tires, the wheels, everything you see on those components came out of Bloomington, Minnesota. And when you ignite and fuel financially trails within Cuyuna and within the state, you also fuel the bike industry in Minnesota. So it's a two-for-one and a double dip and a really good ROI. Thank you.
Questions, members? Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lulick, I think you're becoming a liberal. No, I'm just Actually, my question, Representative Lulick, is who owns the mineral rights underneath this park?
Representative Lulick?
I believe the state of Minnesota, the citizens of Minnesota.
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Luke, I'm just trying to figure out what, as you know, we've expanded our scrap mining operations extensively on the Mesabi Iron Range, on the overburden piles. But with new technology, you know, every day we're finding new mining opportunities. So I'm just trying to figure out what would happen under the circumstances that the owners of the mineral rights would want to pursue scrap mining or some other mining underneath the park, since, you know, obviously you only own the surface rights.
Absolutely, yeah. That would start a real discussion within the Department of Natural Resources. If you take a look, that's certainly something that would have to be faced in the future. Mm-hmm. But let's see, 60, that's 40, 50. We've watched that now for 50 years, and that that community has moved ahead on this project. So there's always that circumstance where literally any place in Minnesota, you're going to have to deal with mineral rights that are basically owned by the state of Minnesota. I'm confident that we've already put a huge investment into this. And we'd have to deal with that if that comes about. My understanding of the scram operations on the Mesabi is that there's several generations of product up there that they have to go through before they are going to even come close to exhausting what they've got there. But that's certainly a question. But at this point, we're working to get something done, not sit around and continue to wait for something like that to happen. I think about those lakes that I had the opportunity to actually ride with my dad to the bottom of when they were open pit mines. They're trout lakes now. Is there likely minerals there yet that possibly could be used? We've got to move on, and it's a huge issue. We're kind of the stepchildren. We were the first one to disappear as far as operational mining of the three ranges. So I'm absolutely behind this, and we've got other mineral deposits in the area that we probably need to be looking at in the first place. In the immediate area, up at Emily and Tamarack. So I can't answer that question, I'll be quite honest with you, but I can tell you I can answer the question for the folks in the area. They're absolutely ready to get on with this and do the best job they can on building their community. And if we run out of ore on the Mesabi, I guess that might be your problem, not mine.
Representative Moline?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And you know, I think from my understanding, there's still private fee holders on portions of the Cuyuna and possibly under the park. And, of course, you know, if they want to claim their rights to their property underneath the park, that's their right to do so. And so, you know, I'm looking at the price tag of $4.2 million, and I just think that I know when we do things on the Mesabi, like move highways, or we've actually talked about doing a bike path as well up by Hibbing Taconite. we always have to take into consideration who owns the mineral rights underneath and whether or not there's going to be any mining underneath there, because, you know, you could be looking at a project where the state is going to put in $4.2 million, and then all of a sudden those private fee holders are going to want to claim their rights to their minerals, and you're going to have to be it's done then. You know, there's nothing that can be done about it. So I just think that, you know, we have to keep that in mind as we're going forward on this bonding project. And I know the IRRB has given some money to this park specifically for improvements there. And I've been there, and it is a beautiful location. But I would just like us to keep in mind that possibility, and maybe we can get some more information on who the fee holders are.
Representative Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I had a couple, you know, following this over the last few years, too, as we funded it at the IRRB. My bigger question would be, so if this ended up going, you get the funding, we move on, a mineral owner comes in, is it going to be something that we try to react legislatively to stop a production of something, or how is that going to work between, I know all the special interest groups, a lot of the communities have already passed resolutions, and by the way, awesome bike to bring in. I want one.
Come on.
But no, I mean, I think it is a serious thing when we're talking about that. We just had some testimony in here a few weeks ago, and the land and surface rights and mineral rights can get contentious. Do you foresee that happening? If so, how would you recommend we react as a group?
Representative Wood.
Thank you, Representative Metzger. Well, I think you have to take that case-by-case basis, and that's an area we'll certainly have to look at. One of the solutions that those mineral rights that don't belong to the state of Minnesota would be to take a look at that and determine if those are purchasable, and again, that would have to be a case-by-case circumstance. But again, I've seen it, 50 years, dead in the water. You know, Crosby and Ironton, Riverton, and one that isn't on here, Trommel. Most people don't know what I'm talking about when I say Trommel, Minnesota. Those are not the towns that I grew up in when the iron mines were going like they are up where you're living in. And, we can't wait another decade, another 50 years to make a determination on whether we're going to really push this economy forward. Back in 93, we made a big investment there by basically declaring that a park area. And I think, that's a decision made that at that point in time, couple decades ago, so we certainly got to be mindful of that. But we can what if ourselves into doing nothing, and I won't buy that for our community there. We can't stand what if in it much longer. We need to build that into a good economic engine. It's halfway there. We just need to push it over the hump so that we can get that 3-4 day destination as opposed to the 1 day. And then they go home, type of thing. So, a lot of bridges to cross, but we want to keep moving forward on this.
Representative Metzger, any other questions, members? Anyone in the audience that would like to speak for or against the bill? Representative Lewick renews his motion that House File 790 be re-referred to the Committee on Environment, Natural Resources, Policy, and Finance. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Motion prevails. The bill is passed on to the Environment and Finance Committee. Thank you very much for coming in. Thank you, Representative Louis. Next on the agenda is Representative Schumacher. Welcome to the committee, Representative Schumacher. The chair will move House File 641 to be re-referred to the Committee on Environment, Natural Resources, Policy, and Finance. Is that where you'd like it to go?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, very good. Please proceed.
All right. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. House File 641 appropriates $846,000 to the Casey Jones Trail that spans southwestern Minnesota. The Casey Jones Trail is one of the state's oldest trails. Named for the famous railroad engineer from Tennessee, the Casey Jones Trail serves as an avenue for Minnesotans to experience the prairie and Buffalo Ridge and all our region has to offer. Even as one of the oldest trails in the state, there is still expansion to be done in order to complete the master plan. In 2002, a group of active citizens, businesses, and nonprofits who have the desire to see the trail's completion formed the Friends of Casey Jones Trail. Here with me today is Mick Myers, Executive Director for the Pipestone Chamber of Commerce and President of the Friends of Casey Jones Trail, to offer more detail.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent.
Mick Myers with the Chamber of Commerce and Convention and Visitor Bureau in Pipestone, Minnesota.
Welcome.
Thank you. One thing we probably won't be talking about would be lakes and mountains, because we're from extreme southwest Minnesota and we have neither. Just a short history there. As Representative Schumacher said, it is one of the first state trails that was designated. It was designated by Representative Vern Long in the late 60s. And it's an old railroad bed. Right now, we have 5 miles of hard surface trail that have been built. And then the next segment would be 5 more miles. We have 2 bridges that are built on that section. And so it is, I guess, as the term goes, you know, shovel ready. This will take us to the Pipestone Murray County line. This trail is it's a dual tread trail that has its beginning or terminus down by Laverne, Minnesota, which is right close to the Minnesota, South Dakota, and Iowa border. And then it'll come up from Laverne through the Blue Mountain State Park. Then it will circle into the Touch the Sky Prairie complex, which is a fish and wildlife program that features some extremely very nice prairie. Then it'll go to Split Rock Creek State Park in Island, Minnesota, up to Pipestone, where we have the Pipestone National Monument. Then it'll go east to Lake Chautauqua State Park, then on up to Walnut Grove, the Laura Ingalls Wilder area, and then on up to the Minnesota River, about 75 miles total when it is entirely finished. All of this has been designated by the state. So it's a huge project, but it is coming along very well. Tourism in our area is considered to be a fantastic economic development generator, and it's, of course, very important also to our area. We have several active living organizations along the way. Laverne is starting one. Pipestone has one. A couple of other communities are looking into it. But this trail will provide some very, very good area for physical exercise and riding and so forth. There's also a lot of trails in the communities. Laverne is doing trails. Pipestone is doing trails that inside of their communities. So as this trail, as the Casey Jones Trails goes through, it will be able to, more people will be able to interact with that trail. And also as this trail moves through in its entirety, there will probably be about 13 different communities that would have the ability of making a trail from their community out to this trail, thus, you know, getting more usage. So I guess all in all, the project is ready to go, and we hope that you could see your way clear to supporting it. Is there any questions that I can answer?
Questions, members? Anyone in the audience that would like to speak for or against the bill? Seeing none, the chair will renew his motion that House File 641 be re-referred to the Committee on Natural Resources Policy and Finance. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Thank you, committee.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Members, tomorrow we'll hear, 5 or 6 bills, mostly game and fish bills, I think. Yeah. Probably be holding them over for possible inclusion in the game and fish bill once we might see one from the Department of Natural Resources. So with that, members, committee is adjourned.